Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. And we're going all Italian today to talk Serie A, Galazzo and much more with a very special guest. In the wake of Italy's success at the recent Euro 2020, still a sore point for some, and the long-awaited dethroning of Juventus in Italy, Serie A is seemingly back in vogue with a new TV deal. Even the return of James Richardson and a certain iconic theme tune. And tonight, we're going to talk to the voice of Sunday evenings on BT Sport, Adam Summerton, all about his long-term love of the Italian game and what appears to be shaping up to be an excellent season in Italy with Napoli setting the early pace over there. So it's a welcome back to the pod for a second These Football Times appearance, Adam. It makes you an official friend of the pod in my book. Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for inviting me back. Must can't have been too bad the first time.
Exactly. It must have gone well. And joining us too this evening are my red and blue Merseyside pals, but I guess we'll have to switch that rivalry from Merseyside to Milan to keep on theme today. So in which case, Stephen Scragg, that makes you AC Milan.
Oh, I can do that. We've got a bit of a kinship with AC Milan. I think they're one of those teams, if you remember them, you can't help but have a bit of a soft spot for them. From that Van Basten, Hullet, Rijkaard era, and having so much Italian talent surrounding that, you know, so even on the basis of that, but throwing Istanbul and Athens and all of that type of stuff, I don't have an Italian team of preference, you know. To be fair, you know, I just embrace it all and love it all. So it makes me feel a bit like Stu when Stu does a podcast and say he doesn't really support anyone. Just loves football. Yeah, I get a bit of that from Italian football. I can just like enjoy a bit of everything. It's like a great kind of like tapas going on there. Wrong country, but you know, it is that kind of vibe, really.
Excellent. And then the blue half of the rivalry then, the Internazionale for tonight only, Paul. Paul McParlan, buongiorno.
Buongiorno. Come sta bene?
Yeah, that's going too far.
great to be on the show, Aidan. Really looking forward to this night. Adam's a fantastic guest. And, as opposed to Stephen, I'm always been firmly on the Nerazzurri side, in particular because Everson's first game in European competition was against Internazionale at Goodison Park. They beat us over two legs, 1-0. I think we had a justified goal disallowed in the return. Like, I think Stephen covers that in his book about the undisputed champions of Europe as well in great detail. And, of course, Romelu Lukaku played for both teams as well. So there's definitely an affinity there between the blue half of Merseyside and the blue half of Milan.
Well, that's worked out well. That makes it seem like I actually planned that. But literally, it was literally the colours, nothing else. Oh, well, that worked out well. I'm pleased about that. Okay, well, last time you were on the pod, Adam, we touched briefly, I guess, on your love of Italian football, and we covered various other themes as well. But we got the chance to go a bit deeper into it this time around. So first thing, I mean, there's often a key moment or period in time when those who love exotic football from far-off lands, to complement what we have on our doorstep, there's a key moment where that kind of falls into place for you, or when it really hits home. So when was this for you, and what was it about Italian football that really hooked you?
I think for me with Italian football, I've kind of had sort of two key moments in my life, really. The first was with Golazzo and Football Italia in the early 90s, and I can almost picture myself sat cross-legged in my mum and dad's back room watching the telly. And at the time, it was when Sky had just got hold of the Premier League, and there were some families, and mine was one of them, where mum and dad were reluctant to start paying the Sky subs, so we couldn't watch Premier League football. They eventually gave in the end, but at that time, we couldn't. And my little mate down the road, his mum and dad had it, but we didn't. So while he was off watching at his house, I would have Football Italia on, because, of course, it was on Channel 4. And I can almost right now smell the roast dinner cooking while I'm sat there watching, you know, the Milan derby or whatever. And it was just kind of like this sort of window to a completely different footballing world, which really drew you in, because partly because it was so different. Obviously, the big names were there, the biggest names in the world at that time, and that has its own pull. But for me, it was, and I was thinking about the things that drew me in when I knew I was coming on here, and I think it was, you know, things like the badges, the crests that were so different, the kits that were so iconic. The names of the stadiums were sort of had this air of mystique about them, you know, Marassi and San Siro, the Olimpico and things like that, you know, so different to a young boy to things like Anfield, Old Trafford, Goodison. Obviously they sound completely different because they're a different language, but I think, and it also goes into, you know, the fan culture, just observing that. And again, how different it was to English culture. You know, the fact that, you know, the name the Ultras as well sparks something in your imagination too. And as well, things like the nicknames and, you know, like you could have the goddess against the devil, you know, it's a Serie A fixture. You know, these things all just set the imagination running. And I think for me, it wasn't just something that stopped when I was a young boy. It carried on into adult life as well. And when I say I've had two points in my life where I've kind of, my interest has peaked, is I suppose because I wouldn't say I completely lost touch with Italian football, but once you got past that kind of Golazzo era, you know, and you become, you get into adult life, and I maybe didn't quite take as much of an interest in it as I had done when I was younger. But then when I became working on it at BT, when BT launched in 2013, and it suddenly became part of my working life again, and I sort of rediscovered it in a way. And the passion for it and just immersing yourself in it because you're covering the league and you need to learn about it. I think that was where sort of reborn in terms of the way that, you know, I really embraced Serie A and everything about it all over again. It was like I rediscovered it once more, and I've never put it down since then, really.
And that's, I mean, you're talking there about the Galazzo and Football Italia and so on back in the early 90s. I mean, this was a time, of course, where there wasn't that much TV. Yes, Premier League had just launched around the same time, maybe 1 year earlier from when Channel 4 began the coverage. I don't know, but you're absolutely right. So many people didn't have Sky Sports at that stage, or B Sky B or whatever was necessary at the time. So what a coup that was for Channel 4. It was incredible. Oh, yeah. It just hit home with so many people, didn't it? And I remember thinking to myself, you talk there about fan culture and ultras and so on. Me as an impressionable teenager at the time, thinking, well, you know, we're getting exposed to this noisy, vibrant, colourful fan culture. And I was kind of thinking, well, that might transpose itself a little bit to our game. And maybe it didn't so much. But I think there's some bits of evidence of it, possibly, in terms of, you know, flags and tifos, as they call it, you know, various things like that at grounds. And that's the kind of thing that hit home. You're absolutely right about these sort of iconic images. I mean, Stephen, I know you've talked before. You got in earlier ahead of everyone else, didn't you? You know, with your managing to get coverage of it pre-Channel 4. So, you were there before all the cool kids got there, weren't you?
Oh, we were lucky that the Merseyside in the Northwest area, you know, you kind of like tuned your television, we could always pick up kind of like HTV instead of kind of like Granada sometimes. And it was the same for Channel 4. So we could pick up S4C, you know, if we kind of like pointed earlier in the right direction. And Monday night, they used to have Scagoria on, and they picked up the coverage in about 89. And they weren't live games, but they were Monday night, you know, highlights basically. And they'd show highlights of Serie A, they'd do the same for La Liga. And the general gist of it was that it was signed so they could kind of like show coverage of Ian Rush playing for Juventus, Mark Hughes for Barcelona. But, you know, fate being what it is, by the time they started broadcasting these programmes, Ian Rush was back in the Liverpool shirt, Mark Hughes was back at Manchester United. But within that, you know, it was just the perfect time because it was Maradona at Napoli. It was, you know, the AC Milan of what I said before about being it was Van Basten, it's Hullet, it's Rijkaard, you know, surrounded by the likes of Donadoni and Ancelotti, and, you know, all Baresi, Maldini, all these names just trip off the tongue. You know, Inter had Klinsmann, Bremer and Mateus. It was just an outrageous league at its very, very strongest. It was, you know, it was wonderful to watch. It was just evocative. And what it was, what became hypnotic about it, and everything that Adam said about the style of it, the kits, the stadiums, and even looking back, you know, watching Liverpool in the 84 European Cup final, seeing the footage of 77, at the Olympico, but an Olympico without the roof on, and you can see the mountains and in the background and everything, the trees and everything, and it just looking, you know, epically, you know, attractive, Latin, brilliant, everything that English football wasn't. Even though, you know, as much as I loved English football, this was like football on a different planet. And the fact that the brutality of the league as well, you know, it was 18 teams at that point in time with four being relegated. It was just wonderfully brutal, you know, and it just, everything seemed stylish about it. We were seeing players like Paul Elliott go and play for Pisa, and you know, Gordon Cowans was going playing for Bari. You know, and he'd be relegated with them and stay with them in Serie B for a couple of seasons. And it was like the best that we could ship out there were playing in teams that were just kind of like scrapping to kind of like stay up. When Graeme Souness went in 84 to Sampdoria, this was a Sampdoria that were a mid-table side that had never won a major trophy. You know, and he'd left the European champions, the best team in Europe at that point in time, to go and play. You know, the wonderful story about him going into contract negotiations with a ballpark figure in his head that he was going to ask for, and then being shocked by being offered three times the amount that he was going to go and ask for. It was, you know, even looking that a bit further back, you know, that those formative memories of football was Liam Brady going to Juventus, and you know, the end of the ban. Looking back, I didn't know there was a ban on foreign players, but you know, I can remember kind of like Brady on the front of Shoot in a Juventus shirt and thinking, God, this place must be an amazing thing to go to. You know, so yeah, you know, it long on my radar, and just absolutely adored her.
One thing Adam mentioned there, he said the phrase, the window into another world, Paul, and that's exactly what it is, isn't it? It's totally exotic, totally different. I mean, this is at a time where stadiums in England were, you know, not the all-seater modern structures that we have now. You know, there was still fences up, weren't there? There was lots and lots of terracing still on its way to being phased out post-Hillsborough. It was utterly, utterly different. Did you point your aerial the right way for this extra coverage as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, as Stephen referred to, there was this thing on Merseyside that if you paid £15, you get an extra aerial that if you tilted towards the Welsh border, you could pick up HTV in Scorio. and it was money well spent, because inevitably the big match always showed better game than the kickoff match on Gunnar Hoddle TV. But I think, as well, as Stephen mentioned there, Scorio was a program that was really ahead of its time, and you know, showed clips of the Italian football, the Spanish football. So you got an insight into European football you didn't get, you know, through the normal terrestrial channels. Adam and Stephen both referenced there as well about the stylishness of Italian football, because you have to kind of remember at that time when Channel 4 coverage started in depth, UK football was still coming out of this vicious circle of hooliganism, decaying stadiums, falling attendances. I think at the time, the Sunday Times described vicious football as being a slum sport played in slum stadiums, increasingly watched by slum people. And that kind of showed you the depths to which British football had kind of sunk in national perception. I think, you know, also as well, I mean, in terms of fashion and trends, you know, as Steve will probably remember from you know, being a football fan in the 80s, it was like kind of de rigueur if you lived in Liverpool to have a Benetton t-shirt and a pair of Diadora trainers, which kind of referenced the Italian style reference there as well. So that kind of linked to the glamour part of it also. And I think the key was Italia 90, when you looked at those stadiums that almost seemed like some of the Thunderbirds compared to what we're used to in England. They were just so ahead of their time, and they just ooze style, glamour, grace. And then I don't know, there's just something, isn't there, about Italian names. You know, Stephen mentioned it on a podcast a while ago. You just want to say Bonansegna because it sounds so great, good. And it does. Yeah. It's a great name. This is it. And this, you know, Donadoni, all these sorts of names just flowed off the tongue. It just exuded a level of sophistication and glamour that we could only, you know, dream to aspire to in England at the time. So yeah, there was just something about Italian football. And as Adam also detailed before, the nicknames of the clubs were just absolutely brilliant, and they just had this kind of ring to them that English football was really struggling to compete with at the time. And I always kind of remember, I've always been a big subscriber when Saturday comes, and one of their editions in 1992 had a cover with Ruud Gullit and Marco van Basten both giving the thumbs up, and in the bubbles, Channel 4 got Serie A for this, you know, this feat compared to what Sky paid for the Premier League, and emphasising that at that time, that was the better deal.
And I was just going to say, on top of all that as well, you throw the fact that they won the World Cup in 82 into the mix.
Exactly.
There.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, for those of us who remembered it, we all had Tardelli, Graziani, Conti, Rossi, you know, Antignoli, and Dino Zoff. You know, all of it was kind of like fresh within mind. So, you know, they were very, very evocative. Sorry, Adam, you go for it.
I was just going to say that people probably don't even realise that first game that they showed, which was that 3-3 draw. They were dead lucky with the first game they showed because it was an absolute classic. Yeah. You know, it drew everybody in even more. But they got 3 million for that. You know, audience size. That is a really healthy audience size. You know, when it, particularly when you consider it wasn't on, you know, one of the established first three channels as well. At an audience of 3 million is not to be sniffed at, and that was a great start, and that really set the ball rolling. As well as it possibly could have done, really, for the Golazzo Football Italia coverage.
That says a lot, though, the fact that we all recall exactly what game you're talking about, the score was, and exactly how it went. So that shows what a big deal it was. And that sort of brings us, I guess, onto the early days of the Channel 4 coverage and which particular teams or players or so on resonated the most. I mean, obviously, Stephen's already mentioned the great Milan side at the time. This was round about their peak era still. You know, the players they had. I seem to have something in my DNA, though, that wouldn't let me support a team like that. You know, they're far too successful for me. I can't possibly go with anyone like that. You know, I love Van Basten. Later on, I love George Weah. I thought they were fantastic, wonderful players. I could appreciate them all, but, you know, there's just something not quite right for me. They're just too good for me. That also meant I couldn't have much love for Juventus, even if they did have Roberto Baggio, another player who I absolutely loved. That's harking back to what you're saying there about Italia 90, the glamour of that competition and the incredible performances he put on there, and a certain goal in particular. I had a bit of a liking for Sampdoria. Obviously, David Platt went there. That was probably the couple of years down the line. Initially, Des Walker was there in the first season of Channel 4's coverage. Ruud Gullit went there as well. So there was a bit of glamour there. And they had a wonderful kit, incredible stadium. So much love about them. So they're still quite high in my affections, I think, from that era as a result, even if Lee Sharp did his best to make those affections slip a little bit. But for me, uppermost in my original Italian love affair was Fiorentina. I think this was a combination of already being aware of their fans' obsessive tendencies with all the Baggio furore ahead of the 1990 World Cup and his move to Juventus, all the controversy that stoked up. Then there was the shaggy-haired striking genius of Gabriel Batistuta, who I thoroughly enjoyed at that time, even if, you know, I think could later come to appreciate he's a little bit of a flat track bully at times, but you know, he banged in plenty of goals and usually quite spectacularly so. And then of course there was the glorious kit. I mean, this is really the main thing. We talked about the colours and the stadiums and things like that, but the kit, you know, you don't see a violet kit very often, and it was beautiful, and it was a cool kit as well. Like Sampdoria's was a cool kit, but there's a certain style about that Fiorentina one that I absolutely loved, and playing in what we've talked about some of the otherworldly stadiums, but Fiorentina's looked like a bit of a crumbling old stadium. And that sealed it for me. That's the ones I loved. And of course, they were suitably hopeless most of the time. So that just fits right for me. But for you, Adam, what was it in terms of, like, was there a particular team, player or anything that you ended up rooting for or following, or that grabbed your attention more than some others?
Well, it's funny because I could really relate to, I think, what Stephen was saying right at the start, where he was talking about not supporting any one team, but being able to just appreciate all of it. And it's actually quite a nice way to watch football, certainly a nice way to embrace a league, because being free of that sort of partisan side of things that we most, nearly everyone who watches football buys into, certainly for your own domestic league, it's actually feels like a little bit of a release at times. And me as a commentator as well, you know, it's quite nice because no one ever accuses me of bias, believe it or not, when I cover Italian football. Whereas every single game I do in England, someone will say that you're being biased towards the other team. So it's quite nice because I quite appreciate that as a commentator of Italian football, because I know how in Italy, and that's one of the things that is quite interesting about their football culture, is that they're always looking for the scandal, aren't they? They're always looking for who's been nobbled by the referee. I mean, that's one of the things that it's just so ingrained in Italian football, isn't it? Suspicion of referees. You know, that's something that's maybe different to in England. So I know people will say, oh, the referees had a bad game, but it's very rare that someone will say that referee's, you know, dodgy or whatever. But in Italy, they'll say it nearly every game. So it's quite it's quite nice that I never really get stick about being, because I think anyone who knows me, you know, from my Twitter and on air knows that I don't support any one team. I just enjoy all of it, really. And I like following them all in Europe as well, the Italian teams and the Italian national side as well, like to keep an eye on. But no, so there was no one team, but yes, there were players. I mean, Baggio, I mean, people called him Badge, didn't they? when we were all growing up, he was, you know, I just remember that obviously with the World Cup and the Divine Ponytail and the fact Madonna fancied him and, you know, all those things that, you know, that stick in your memory. So, and clearly the Dutch trio at Milan as well were, and players like Maldini as well, Battistuta, fantastic at Fiorentina. I mean, it's just so many players because, I mean, if to try and explain it to somebody who is maybe, you know, in their teenage years now, it's like the Premier League is now in a way in that most of the best players were there and it had huge TV revenues as a result of that. And it was just the best league by far. I suppose in some way, maybe even more of the star names were there than there are in the Premier League, right? If that makes sense, in terms of concentration purely of the best players.
You could call it like the European Super League before that was even a thing.
Yeah, it was just... And then when you saw British players like Platt and Souness and Brady and I suppose Ian Rush was one of the first as well that stays in my memory, that kind of... It kind of made you feel like you were a bit more part of it, if that makes sense, because people who were from your country had gone over there, so you could kind of own it a little bit more. But no, there wasn't, as I say, there wasn't one particular team. I just admired the whole culture of it all. And you absolutely nailed it with the kits. And even now, Fiorentina and Sampdoria, I think, are still the two best kits even now. Because I've got quite a collection in my wardrobe upstairs. And they're definitely two kits that I love saying things like Laviola. I mean, it just means the purple. But when you say Laviola, you just feel great about yourself, right? it has that air of mystique and the Artemio Franchi and things like that. It's just brilliant. It's quite good to get to my age and still kind of have that almost like boyish enthusiasm and not lost it. That says a lot for the pull of that league and that time and how it stayed with me. And I'm sure you're all very similar as well.
I'd like to know how you get away with ordering loads of kits, because every time I try and do that, I get told off for being sad. Never mind.
That's one benefit of becoming single.
Well, I might suggest that, but we'll see how it goes. But Stephen, I know you like Adam there, there wasn't a particular team that sort of won your affections, but presumably certain players did more so than others.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, within that, you know, no one predominant team kind of like, you know, drew my, you know, love as such, but, you know, you have that kind of admiration for various teams and, you know, it's like the Parma of the 1990s. You can't not love the Parma of the 1990s. And it is just a case of kind of like walking into the sweet shop and wanting a bit of everything, you know, and you know, even kind of like the likes of Genoa, you know, another iconic kit, or, you know, Bologna, you know, many respects, sometimes it's down to the teams that Baggio swept through, you know, a soft spot for Brescia and that chevron on the show.
Oh, you've got to love the white chevron, different. Exactly.
So, you know, there's just so much going for it, but, you know, you can just kind of like, you know, tick through every single one. You know, it's things like just that utter, I don't know, that kind of like doomed essence of Inter for so many years as well, you know, throwing so much money at trying to chase the Scudetto down and not being able to do it, you know, that loss on the final day to Juventus and you know, the rancor that surrounded it, league titles that were there to be won and they didn't, you know, when Verona won, it was Inter's to lose and lose it they did, you know, but it comes down to like the coaches as well. You know, when you're looking at Arrigo Sarri, it's Fabio Capello, you know, Giovanni Trapattoni, always fascinated by Trapattoni's years at Inter more than anything else, because, you know, it gave as much as it took. You know, there was the glories, but the ones that he missed out on. You know, that amazing Sampdoria victory in 1991, which was prime Scagorio territory for me. because they you know, Boskov and that wonderful side that kind of he saw off kind of like Sarki's Milan and Trapattoni's Inter. And not just that, you know, there was a decent Parma that season and Juventus were in it, you know, for the first half of that season. You know, just so much that it had going for it, but also kind of like the support acts. Zeman's Foggia were just so much fun to watch, you know, and that was what I got a great deal out of it was, you know, the fun of it. And I think Channel 4's coverage of it when it eventually came, you know, kind of like tapped into that, you know, James Richardson with the great big huge ice cream or the huge coffee and, you know, kind of deciphering the front page of the sports papers and, you know, everything just, you know, it had the glamour, but the way that it was covered in this country just kind of like poked a bit of fun at it as well. So, you know, it was a no lose situation because just every team seemed to have something going for it. And within that, you know, there were some big casualties as well at that point in time that ended up dropping down to Serie B and even C. You know, Napoli went, Sampdoria went down, Torino many times over, you know, Inter flirting with it in the mid-1990s. It was just kind of like, you know, yes, you had the success, but the disasters were almost kind of like a operatic, you know, sense of doom about some of it, which was just hypnotic.
Now, how about you, Paul? Were you a Milan's Dutch trio or an Inter German trio man?
Well, neither, actually, because when I first started, I was looking to follow Torino because I've always been fascinated by the history of Torino. There was Supergar and how the club never recovered from that, how they lost their preeminence in Italian football to Juventus, and I've kind of struggled ever since then. So I was always fascinated by the history of Torino. I love the kiss as well. I mean, I know it's a plain shirt, but La Granata sounds so much better than maroon, doesn't it? And you know, as Adam mentioned before, and I think it's one of the nickname Toro. It just has this nice ring to it as well. And then you looked at the history of the club with the Philadelphia stage and then the ill-fated move to the Stadio dell'Alpi. So I was always fascinated by Torino. Unfortunately, when the coverage starts on Channel 4, it was one of Torino's kind of high periods because they won the Coppa Italia in 93. And then about 4 years later, Steve mentioned they got relegated from Serie A. But I also remember just as our season started, they sold Gianluigi Lentini to AC Milan, who at the time was the world's most expensive player. And I remember all the processing from the Torino fans about that transfer, how devastated they were that he went. And of course, it never worked out for Lentini at AC Milan. And he ended up coming back to spend the full season at Torino anyway. So I found that the whole thing with Torino fascinating to watch. And I also love one thing watching Channel 4 did for me, in particular James Richardson on Saturday one, was give you a real insight into a level of football rivalry that we didn't quite have to the same extent here in England at the time. I loved the rivalry between, you know, Torino and Juventus, the bitterness, the hatred. You know, it kind of made you feel good that maybe it's not just British football that has these kind of, you know, the deeply embedded enmities between teams. I loved it when Napoli came to play at Juventus and the Juve fans are holding up banners saying, "Welcome to Italy," kind of mocking them being from Southern Italy, which once again is something we didn't get in the UK. And then it was kind of this deep level of antagonism between the clubs and the city. So it kind of gave an insight into a whole level of football and a way of viewing football matches, because in terms of how Italian fans organise banners and protests, you know, I remember one infamous game where was that the Milan fans had their backside sticking out through a banner to the Inter fans said, "This is what your reflection looks like," or something like that. and also it gave an insight into the power the fans had in Italy over the club. You know, with the ultras selling tickets, and you know, you had to be an ultra to gain access, you know, to away matches and things like that. So it really gave you an understanding into like another way the football could operate. Not all of it was good, not all of it was positive, but I think certainly in terms of influencing maybe fan groups over here as to how you could have more say in the direction of your club, I think the whole Channel 4 transmission of Serie A was real insight into another way of dealing with the football authorities at the time.
That's one of my favourite things about, as a commentator covering Serie A, is the rivalries that you've just mentioned there, because they are so deep-seated, so deep-rooted, and they have such long memories. You know, like the Fiorentina fans are still furious about Liam Brady. You know, they're still furious. You know, and that's what is another thing as a commentator that feeds in so much into your sense of anticipation and eagerness for a particular fixture, not just because of what it matters in terms of the table in that particular moment. It goes beyond that. It goes like 20, 30 years back into something that happened between the two clubs. And that is something that is very special about Italian football for me.
Yeah.
Now, Adam, you've got the plum job coming onto TV coverage of Italian football. You've got the plum job of commentating each week on Italian games for BT Sport. Atalanta v Milan, I think, just recently for you. Now, BT have got the rights for the next three seasons, I believe, taking over from Premier Sports. So this, I guess, is bringing it away from a even more sideline broadcaster into somewhere that's a little bit more mainstream, even if it is still obviously behind paywall. But I think it's a match made in heaven, I think, in some ways, because it's bringing a bit more focus to the Italian league, obviously, that may have been dwindling. It's something that you referred to again through, I guess, the early part of the 21st century as well, that the coverage maybe wasn't so much. And for me, looking in from the outside, it seems BT are giving Serie A some good prime attention, adding a bit more glamour to it again, I guess, pushing an exciting league with a fairly all-encompassing approach. You know, we've mentioned Galazzo from the Channel 4 days, but obviously you've now got, well, a show called the same thing, but that's a highlights package and so on a Sunday evening, as well as the various live games, which brings some elements, I guess, similar to BT's Champions League coverage of dotting around the grounds type of approach. Must be a very exciting time to be involved, a great thing to be a part of.
Oh, hugely. I mean, when BT first launched and they had Serie A, I ended up doing the Sunday night game as part of the European football show, which you might remember had the goals from Germany and France. And it was great fun to work on. And, you know, just to hear James say, you know, and over to Adam Summerton for the commentary was just brilliant, because obviously I'd grown up watching James covering Italian football when I was a kid, sat in my shorts, and now he's queuing to me. So yeah, the first time that happened, it was a bit of a wow, did that really just happen type moment. But
I hope it didn't put you off what you were saying.
No, I just thought, I think in my head there was just this that little boy's voice saying, wow, that's ace. You
know, wait till I tell my friends.
Yeah, but you're being professional at the same time and you just crack on. But yeah, I mean, it was that, but that's the great thing about it, and I think that's why I enjoy it so much, because yes, I am able to be a commentator, you know, I am able to be professional, but at the same time there is that little bit of me deep inside that is still that little kid watching it as who's almost screaming, going, this is brilliant that, you know, that you're doing this. So that it's why I always say with every league that I do, and I'm quite fortunate in that I do lots of different leagues, everything, you know, from non-league football to Italian football, the Champions League, the Premier League, Europa League, whatever, women's football, whatever I do, I always try my best to totally immerse myself in it and learn it and do the hard yards, because I think that's really where you get authority on air. It's where it makes your commentary better if you have that more authority, not necessarily to other people, but to yourself, that you know as a commentator, you've done the research, so you know that you know your subject. And I think that once you've immersed yourself in it, you can't help but sort of, it just becomes a little part of your life, if that makes sense. And you sort of, you're always looking out for it, and you want to know the history about it, and you want to know the future of it and the present of it, and you really buy into it. So it was just fantastic news. I mean, I think I was pestering my boss over the summer saying, have we got it yet? Is it done yet? Because I was just so, you know, I was so looking forward to us getting it back, because obviously, you know, being working in the industry, you hear little whispers that things could happen. And so to get it back is just brilliant. And I'm really pleased that you think that, from what you were saying there, that we're doing it justice, because, you know, that's important, to give it the respect that it deserves, to give it the coverage it deserves. And I think full credit to BT for, you know, going and getting James to front the show as well. And James Horncastle, they're a great combination. They do really well. And we're having a great time doing it. And hopefully that comes across on air.
Oh, very much so. And Stephen, I know you've been mentioning the coverage on Sunday evenings that you've been watching and enjoying that. Do you think, is it possible for it to attract a new audience to Italian football, or to fall for Italian football more in the way that those of us from the late 80s or early 90s could with the Channel 4 coverage or the Welsh version that you were watching. or is that too much of an ask nowadays for a subscription platform in the modern age?
Well, I think there's the chance to draw in a new audience. I think Italy winning, you know, Euro 2020 brings, you know, greater focus on it. And I suppose within that, you know, the always leagues and you know, always go round in certain cycles. You know, they have an upward curve and a downward curve. And, you know, we're in an era now where Italy are reigning European champions. You know, people will be interested in knowing more about that. Why is that? What is so good about their players? And it will draw people in. You know, hopefully one day that there'll be another major tournament in Italy. And then that will be another springboard into gaining, you know, greater interest. And, you know, I've noticed more people talking about the Italian game, you know, since the start of this season. The fact that Juventus have been knocked off the top, that's, you know, the coverage is that little bit more accessible than it was for the last couple of seasons. And, you know, it just has that inkling that it feels like it's a league that's on the up as far as a UK perspective is concerned. And, you know, hopefully that will grow and grow.
And Paul, Adam was mentioned there having James Richardson, obviously. Now, that is just one man, of course, and a massive team that's working on it. But I guess he brings with him a certain kudos and a certain nostalgia, I guess, that will draw extra people in, I would have thought.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Right now, I think as well, he would bring in people who grew up watching, you know, Serie A on Channel 4, but also I think he would attract the younger audience as well. I remember watching the Golasso BT film about a year ago with my son, who's 20 now, and he was sitting there absolutely riveted by Sydney. You couldn't believe how good the coverage was. There's this guy there with this big ice cream sundae in front of him on the table, sipping his cappuccino. I mean, even now, you know, 30 years later, it's a level of sophistication that, you know, we still aspire to in England from time to time. So he was just totally taken up by the whole experience. And I think, as Stephen referenced there, it's a unique opportunity for Italian football now to really kind of re-establish itself as prime viewing, because A, you've got the blanket coverage on BT, you know, which Adam, you know, has mentioned, and it is covering so well. I think as well the fact that, you know, for last season and maybe this season, it's the most open Serie A it has been for a decade almost. I think that creates a level of interest also. And I think also, you know, As Stephen mentioned before, Italy winning the Euro this summer, I think, also creates a level of interest in the players and in the country. So I think what would probably seal the deal is an Italian side winning the Champions League this year. I think that would really just put the focus back on the country even more so. But for anyone like ourselves who grew up watching Italian football, one thing I think younger supporters, I think the younger generation has grown up much more stats-based than what we ever were. They're much more into information and analysing players' performance than what we ever were. And I think as well, based on that, I'm sure there's a growing appreciation amongst the younger generation of how tactically aware Italian sides are, how good they are at holding on to a 1-0 lead, how good they are at seeing out the game. And I think the way Italy performed in the Euros, you know, absolutely encapsulates that, because in terms of the tactics, everything was absolutely spot on. When you look back at that Euro final, I know it's kind of, you could describe it as cynicism at its height, but when Saka tried to get past Chiellini, and Chiellini just pulled him back and took the yellow card, you said, sorry, son, you're going nowhere. And it was just this desire to win, this level to win that maybe to an extent we haven't quite gotten in this football at the moment. So, yeah, I think it's good that there's so many live games on BT Sports at the moment. There's so much choice that you can pick. And sometimes after you've sat through like a boring 0-0 home draw with Burnley, you're kind of desperate to watch a bit of Italian Batman, aren't you?
Can I tell you a quick story about, just quickly, Aidan, about James?
Absolutely.
So the first show that we did this season with Golazzo Live, him and James Horncastle presenting it, and we went over, Don Hutchison, we were doing the commentary, and I don't think I'm giving away any secrets to say that we're in a little booth just over the other side of the building from where they present it. So we said, come on, let's go over and see them. And we were laughing as we were walking over about some of the things that James used to persuade these world stars to do back in the 90s, you know, like, you know, things that pros probably would never, you know, you'd have to go through their agent and they'd just say no straight away, some of the things he got them doing. And one of them was Lombardo. Do you remember where Lombardo did the Lombardo with the sound man and the mic boom in the air and all that? And we, Don and I were talking about that as we went over, and then we went over and we're chatting to the two Jameses. And as we're chatting away, James Richardson gets out his camera phone to record a little sort of teaser for the show with us there and all of us involved. And I'd already said before, I'm not doing anything stupid. Before I know it, I'm stood there with Don. Don and I are dancing the Lombardo. So as we're walking away, I said, and I hadn't even thought about it. I just did what he asked me to do. As we're walking away, I said to Don, you know, we said before, how did he get those guys to do those things? Well, there's your answer.
And on that
theme, just done it to us.
On that theme, Paul, you mentioned the sophistication of James with his cakes and ice creams in the cafes, but he also had Gazza doing various skits as well. So there's nothing sophisticated about that side of the coverage, but it was all fun. Now, you mentioned there, of course, that Italy are the new European champions. Now, it feels a little bit of a fresh open wound to talk about that too much, but if we ignore a certain penalty shootout for now, Italy are clearly a national team who've been on a steadily rising path. Obviously, they failed to qualify for the last World Cup, but since then, they've been on a very long, lengthy unbeaten run. At the time of recording, that goes back some 37 matches and 3 full years. But as we speak, they're actually playing their Nations League semi-final and losing 2-0 to Spain right now. So I guess that run is coming to an end. But nonetheless, 3 years unbeaten is an astonishing run for a team in turmoil. I mean, we talk about the impact this might have on Serie A and popularity, I suppose. Can this be a springboard to a rebirth in the league's popularity alongside the coverage, obviously, you're doing, the league itself, as well as the focus on the national team and the success of the national team? The league seems increasingly entertaining, like nothing like the old time-worn stereotypes, even if Italy isn't quite the Super League in terms of player names that it once was. Does the national team success not just reflect on the league, but drive popularity in it as well?
I think Italy and Italian football feels good about itself right now, and it's hard to underestimate how far that can take you, both as a league and as a nation, and just your overall. We know that it feeds into all the other aspects of life, as we know from just seeing what England was like when the team got to the final this year, and the euphoria that spread right across the country. So yeah, it feels good about itself right now, and it's come from an extremely low ebb to get to that point. I mean, Italian football in terms of the national side was at its lowest ebb for decades before, you know, Mancini took over, and I guess now you could say the rest is history. So whether it will translate into a sort of a, you know, to drive Serie A on, I suppose the maybe negative cynical side of me says that money is king, and I think that the Premier League so far ahead of everybody else right now in terms of the financial side of things, that it's difficult to see that happening. But what we do have undoubtedly is it's coincided Italy winning that European Championship with, for various reasons, the most competitive Serie A in terms of the title race that we've had for some time. There's so many stories right now in there always is in Italy, but you know, you've got Mourinho going back, you know, you've got Juventus not quite the force that they were, you've got the Rossoneri revival, you know, finished second and looked like they could challenge for the Scudetto this time, you've got Inter after, you know, a decade suddenly have won the league title again. So there's a lot, you know, Atalanta have just been incredible for the last few years, 3 seasons they've finished in the Champions League position. So there's so many different facets to it right now. It isn't just one team dominating. And I think that is so important for a league in terms of attracting attention outside of its own borders to say to people abroad, look at our product. You know, we've got a really good title race here. It's things that maybe Germany can't do right now. Perhaps France can't really realistically. I know Lille won it last season, but I think Paris are going to run away with it this year. So it's more difficult for them to sell their leagues right now, but Italy has no problem in that respect. And just to finish that point, I think that is, when I say sell the league, that for me is something that Italy doesn't do well enough. I think that the publicity side of things, the PR side of things, even the social media type things. I still think there's a lot of room for improvement there. If I'm to sort of nitpick about the way that the league sells itself, it's got a fantastic product. I'm not always so sure that they market it quite as well as they could do. And I'm not, it's not just me saying that. I know a lot of people who follow Italian football of, you know, English speaking Italian football followers have said that as well. So I think they could be better at that. And as well, another thing that perhaps, and something that's going to be very difficult for them to do in Italy, if they are again to, if the league's to kick on in terms of global popularity, is to sort out the stadiums, because that's something that happened in England a long time ago. And it's important because I think sometimes when people, particularly abroad, will look at a league and they will see not necessarily crumbling stadiums, but stadiums perhaps in a level of disrepair, and also because they're so vast, some of them, that it's almost impossible for them to be full week in, week out. I think if you can see lots of empty seats and you sort of got half an eye on it, you think, well, why should I watch this if the people who live there can't be bothered to go and watch it? And I think that is an issue that Serie A still hasn't fully addressed. Yes, and you look at maybe Juventus Stadium, where that's probably the best example, isn't it, of a sort of a modern stadium. And I think that they need more of those stadiums. You know, the Olimpico is wonderful, and so is the San Paolo, but they're so vast, and very often they're half, even a third full. And I wonder whether that is still something that needs addressing in Italian football in terms of its, you know, its popularity and it moving on and being the best product it possibly can be.
And Paul, what would of the national team itself then? You know, they seem to go from boom and bust. We talked there about their biggest low for decades, I guess, of 2018 and missing out, followed by one of their biggest highs for several years. Like, well, obviously since 2006 and a World Cup win. Only 3 years later, from the depths of despair to a tournament victory, it does seem a bit boom and bust. Presumably, though, you imagine that they'll ride the crest of a wave a little bit longer this time, perhaps, and they'll obviously be a strong contender for the next World Cup.
Yeah. Well, you'd like to think so, Aidan. I mean, I know they're stumbling a bit in the current World Cup qualification campaigns, but I still think they're strong enough to come through that. And one of the things I think English football can kind of learn from Italy is that when you're on the top of the wave, Italian football is so good at delivering in the major competitions when they've got the right manager and the right team. And certainly coming into the Euros this year with that long unbeaten record, and with a manager who lots of people questioned his ability when he's in charge of Man City, and now you kind of look back and think, actually, maybe he wasn't that bad. Maybe he didn't quite get the credit he deserved. But I just think the way that Italy performed in the Euros this year, it was just a masterclass of making the most of your resources, but also a masterclass in team spirit as well. I just felt the way the whole side fought for each other. And also, I mean, it may or may not have been a factor. I don't want everyone to think about this, but I think the fact that the majority of the squad played in Serie A as well, whether that helps the team to bind together a bit more, whether that creates a culture of achievement, I'm not sure. And unlike England, you know, we've kind of, you know, made semi-finals, the odd final here, and they won the World Cup once, but we haven't got the same level of achievement that Italian football has got in major competitions. And any time a major competition comes around, you're never back against Italy. And it is a bit boom or bust. They can go out in the first round or they can go all the way to the final. But I think it's never boring being a fan of the Italian national team, is it? Because you're never quite sure what you're going to get in any given day, in any given competition. So you go from the lows of, you know, blowing the 1990 World Cup when everything was more or less stacked in their favour, to the incredible achievements of going to Germany in 2006 and lifting the World Cup there, but actually nobody found them to do so at all. So it must be a real roller coaster being an Italian football fan. But they've always been one of my favourite teams to watch. I just love the way Italians can defend and hang on to a 1-0 lead at international level. One game really sticks in my mind. I think it was the Euro 2000s when Italy played Holland, and Italy had two players sent off, was it? And Holland missed two penalties during the game, and somehow Italy held on to the 0-0 draw and beat them in the penalty shootout. And that was just a classic performance by the Azzurri. I was just watching full of admiration because I couldn't think of any other country in world football who could dig in like that and then sneak through on penalties at the end.
And you mentioned there about the coach, and that something springs to mind about Italian coaches, and we see a number of them all across Europe, and many of the top clubs, Premier League included. is they all have to sort of, they all have to study, and they go away. Is it Covaciano? I think the National Federation Center, and they all have to provide a thesis on their coaching philosophy, rather than just simply passing a badge, like you maybe is all you need to do in this country. It seems almost like getting a doctorate or something like that, or a master's degree. You know, you've got to actually provide a thesis, go in depth on your coaching philosophy. And I think that shows a lot, not just in what you might see, you're talking there, Paul, of a traditional Italian style of being able to dig in and grind out the win no matter what, whatever comes along, but equally being adept at various tactics and be able to impose style.
Just going back to that, I've used this quote before, so sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I remember Rafa Benitez saying that when he was first appointed as Napoli manager, in his first press conference, he said to the reporters, "I've been asked more questions about tactics here in the first 5 minutes of this press conference than I was ever asked in England." And that kind of shows you the difference in terms of the level of intuition and understanding of Italian fans and Italian reporters.
Did you hear what Mourinho said just recently? Something very similar when he went back to Italy with Roma in the first press conference. He said that, you know, in England, all they want to know is about, you know, the scandal or the controversy. And he said, when I was in England, I really longed for the Italian press conferences where we talked about tactics. But he says, now I'm back here, I don't want to talk about tactics because you lot are too good at analysing it all.
That's a brilliant quote.
That's great. Now, Stephen, we've talked about the stadiums and we've talked a little about Italia 90. Do you think there would be any renewed effort to host a major international tournament in Italy? Well, they're hosting the Nations League now, but I guess that doesn't count. Do you think a World Cup or a Euros may find its way over to Italy anytime soon?
It'll come down to financial appetite and the stadiums being up for it. You know, Italy did several times make moves to try and host the European Championship over the last 20 years or so, which they failed upon. There was a growing problems with hooliganism went a long way towards them failing to take those European Championships. But everything is in place, you know, aesthetically, you know, I think the continent would love Italy to take on another major tournament. You know, our generation would dearly, dearly love to see, you know, a major international tournament rattling around in beautiful Italian stadiums and wonderful cities. It will come down to just how in decay are those great iconic stadiums, how much would it cost to renovate them? And, you know, it's that financial appetite for it. But, yeah, you know, it has to happen eventually. But when is that eventually? You know, is that within the next decade, or we talk about 2, 3, 4 decades down the line?
It would be glorious, though, let's all be honest.
Wouldn't it?
It
would.
It's so evocative.
And especially if they have the dots down the side of the screen and stuff like that. It would be really, really, yeah, it would be much appreciated.
Wasn't it great when they had the opening ceremony of Euro 2020 there? I mean, that gave us an insight,
yeah,
didn't it?
That's the great thing, though, isn't it? Not just Italy winning the tournament, but... And let's be honest, they were the best team. They were by far the best team in the tournament and worthy winners. But yes, having those games in Rome, it must at least, I don't know, it must pique the appetite of some people within the positions of power within the Italian game.
Now, going back to domestic matters then, obviously Inter Milan broke the Juventus monopoly last season after 9 seasons, I think, of the same winner. Napoli, top now, but even behind them, you've got to go a fair way down the list to find Juventus currently, with Milan and Inter both performing well. Fiorentina, I know, are quite high up there as well, so that's all looking good for some of us. Do you think, Adam, that Juventus's troubles last year and then now are more to do with having a coach? We talked there about Italian coaches. They had a coach who was a big name, but with no coaching track record whatsoever. Or dare we say, even a deference to the great Ronaldo?
I think there have been some bad decisions made in Juventus over the last, 3 or 4 years. And I'm afraid to say that, and some people will, and I know there are still people out there that won't believe that I say this, but a lot of it is down to the signing of Ronaldo. And I'm not saying that in hindsight. I'm saying it, I said it at the time. It was a huge mistake to sign Ronaldo. And that isn't because Ronaldo didn't do what he was expected to do, which was score bucketfuls of goals, because he did. Ronaldo did what it says on the Ronaldo tin. The problem was that Juventus got so close to their holy grail of winning the Champions League, twice beaten finalists under Allegri, not because of an individual, but because of what a good team they were. But how you talked earlier about how they all buy into it defensively. You know, you saw Buffon, Chiellini and Bonucci and Barzagli all celebrating not conceding a goal like they'd scored one. I think Juventus lost a lot of that when they became utterly reliant on one individual player who's in his mid-30s and had no longevity, and were paying him way more than anybody else at the club, way more than anybody else in the entire league. That isn't Juventus. That isn't how they'd got to the points they'd got of winning 9 league titles in a row and coming so close to winning the Champions League. And they did it simply because their utter obsession with winning the Champions League again meant that they just thought, we can't take this anymore. We've got to win the Champions League. Who'll deliver it? He will. He'll do. Get him in. Let's win the champ. And it was short-termism, and they're paying for it. And, you know, it set them back and they've got to build again now. And they've got Allegri back, which personally I think is a good decision. But it isn't going to happen overnight. I mean, Ronaldo scored more than a third of Juve's league goals over the last 3 seasons. You can't just flick a switch and expect to be a team again. So, you know, for Juventus, I think they can get back to, you know, being a side you look at. When you look at the start of a season, you go, who could win the Champions League? And you would say, Juve have got to be talked about. I don't see them as that right now. I know they had that good win against Chelsea, but I still think they're not nowhere near ready to win the Champions League yet. I mean, I might be proved wrong, but they just don't look ready to me. I mean, you look at the midfield, just for example, you know, compare that the midfield they have now to the one that had Pirlo, Vidal, Marchisio, and Pogba as the four, you know, the 3 from 4, wasn't it? And now it's just not at that level, is it? So there's a lot of work to do at Juventus, but I think they'll be involved in the title conversation this season, but it'll be really competitive. And, you know, to get back to being Champions League challengers season in, season out, I think there's a fair bit of work there to do still.
Now, Paul, we mentioned Jose Mourinho. Obviously, he's with Roma now, and he's got Tammy Abraham doing rather well with him there at the moment. Do you think we talked there about the press conference and so on, but do you think overall he's happier there? He seems to be less criticised or less scrutinised in the same way that we're talking about he was in England. Or equally, didn't have the sort of cult of Mourinho, I guess, that we seem to have in England for a time anyway. Do you think he actually prefers it there and can actually get better success now at this time of his career than what he's able to manage in England, which hasn't been that successful in the last couple of efforts?
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see how it develops with Mourinho this season, because he obviously has a... He's obviously raised via his success at Internazionale as one of the top coaches in Italy, but that was like almost 10 years ago now. So it's a long time since he's delivered a trophy in Italy. And I think, you know, in terms of the Roma job, there's not the same... I don't think that there's the same pressure being manager of Roma as what there is being manager of Man United or Chelsea in terms of the emphasis to play attacking football week in, week out. So I think it could be a good manager for them, because I think Mourinho is, you know, I'd referred before about tactics. I think tactically, Mourinho will enjoy that part of the job. He'll quite enjoy, you know, getting a 1-0 win, getting a 0-0 draw away from home to keep his side in contention. And I think from Mourinho's own personal CV point of view, I mean, for him, he's 58 now, is he something like that, 55?
You're on your own on this one.
Okay. Well, I'm guessing he's mid. Look, let's split the difference. He's mid 50s. Okay. So you could
58.
Take 58. Right. I was right first time. you could take the view that this is his last chance to establish himself again as a top ranking European coach. And I think if he can get Roma into the Champions League this season, and then given his record in that particular competition, you know, you wouldn't absolutely back against Roma making progress and inroads in that tournament the following season. So it's going to be fascinating to see how things unravel at Roma for Mourinho. But when you look at some of the other clubs in terms of, you know, inexperienced managers being in charge, and Adam mentioned the Juve experiment last season that didn't work out too well, and they've gone back to experience again, is Serie A the time the type of competition where more experienced coaches are more likely to get success than maybe in other European leagues. So I certainly wouldn't bet against Mourinho achieving something over this year.
And it's actually, we talk about colour schemes and kits and all of that. It's lovely to see Roma back at the top again. Yes, what a lovely kit they have. The colours again, it's glorious, isn't it? Stephen, for you, obviously, are we possibly seeing the start of several years of a proper title battle in Italy? You know, the English Premier League, for all its ills, at the sharp end of the Premier League in recent years, there's a bit of a rotation of who's winning or who's contending, which makes it unique, I guess, well, at least amongst the top four or five clubs anyway, across Europe, in that it is possible for different teams to win, even if you have to be part of that small club still. But Italy hasn't had that for a long time. But do you think the way it's changed, Inter Milan last year, the Napoli unbeaten after seven games so far this year, and various other teams contending, that this might be the start of a sort of prolonged spell of different clubs challenging to make it actually exciting, not just in terms of the football, but in terms of the outcome?
I think there's hope. You know, as Adam's so brilliantly, you know, described Juventus's travails, which remind me a little bit of kind of like late 1980s, early 1990s Real Madrid, and how they lost domestic focus by that desire, that obsession with winning the European Cup again. So yes, they've kind of taken their eye off the ball somewhat, and there is work to do to put them back there. You know, Inter have just won the title, but then they've lost Lukaku. You know, the spectre that are behind Inter have instability, but they have still started the season very, very well. You know, Napoli have been so good to start this season so well, but they've been so consistent in the last decade or so. You know, behind Juventus being this dominant, omnipresent force, this monopoly, you know, Napoli have been, you know, the most compelling alternative. You know, the last two seasons a little bit inconsistent, but you know, it looks like they're coming good again. And again, the psychology of football and whether they can get their head through the potential of being league champions. You know, I always put it, when I was watching Liverpool chase it for 30 years, it's the distance between travelling between can do it and will do it. You know, and it seems such a short step, but it can be such a big step. But then you look at Milan as well, and I think some certain teams, across, not just in Italy, but across the spectrum, I think they've looked at Klopp's Liverpool and say that, you know, yes, there is a way of doing it and be able to compete with the big checkbooks, you know, and being very clever with the way that you construct your teams, and you might need to sacrifice a player to bring in two or three. You know, we lost Coutinho, but it brought us Alisson and Van Dijk. You know, there are trade-offs to be done. And Milan actually approached Liverpool to study how they had done this, how they had come back off. And, you know, Milan have their own system in place. And you know, it wouldn't surprise me if they came good in the years to come, whether that's this season or the seasons beyond. But it does, you know, bring hope. You know, say you look at Atalanta and how well they've done in recent seasons, almost to the point that they've become a new Parma, almost. So, you know, yes, there is that hope that, you know, in the coming seasons, that there will be more competitive league titles there, and that, you know, that there's at least two or three teams that can be amongst the chase and be a regular for challenging for the title.
Well, let's close things off by bringing it back to this season then, and quick prediction time. Having talked all about Serie A and how it's evolving and how exciting it all is this year, prediction then, who is going to win Serie A this season? Adam.
This is so tough. I'm really struggling with this. I'm gonna say Inter, with little conviction, if I'm honest. but I just, and one of the main, well, the main reason I say Inter is Inzaghi. I've prattled on about Inzaghi and how much I rate him to anyone who listened for a good number of years now. And I'm really pleased for him that he's got a job you know, the side that are in the Champions League and that can challenge to win the league, which maybe he didn't quite have at Lazio. I just feel that pound for pound, he's been the best coach in Italy over the last 5 years, particularly when you consider what he inherited, you know, the mess with when Bielsa came and went, and, you know, he knew he wasn't first choice at Lazio. And I just really rate him as a coach. And I think it's been an encouraging start after a difficult summer. Yes, I respect the fact that they've lost Hakimi and they've lost Lukaku, but I think Dzeko's had an exceptional start there. And it's still a really deep squad, actually. I mean, I know that they lost two of their best players from last season, but it's still a really deep squad. I mean, the off-the-pitch financial side of things, who knows where that will eventually end. That makes me worry about them off the pitch for the future. But in terms of on the pitch for this season, I think that they might just have enough to get over the line. But I think it could be really close. I wouldn't be surprised if Juve got themselves right in contention somehow, just because, you know, you have to almost say it because they're Juve, you know, will they find a way? And, you know, Milan look, I thought the performance that Milan put in last Sunday's game against Atalanta, I mean, that really grabbed my attention. I was like, these have got to be taken seriously. That was really impressive. I don't think Atalanta will have enough to challenge for the league, but I think they'll challenge for top four again. Roma are probably similar. I think Napoli are the side that you've got to keep an eye on as well. I mean, God, can you imagine Naples if they won the league again? I mean, it would. Do you remember the famous story when they won it for the first time and there was the banner on the graveyard's wall the days that followed? You don't know what you missed. I mean, we'd be talking that kind of level, wouldn't we? Yeah. I mean, that would be remarkable if Napoli could do it.
That would, yeah, as a football romantic, that's the outcome I would love to happen. I don't know whether they can last the pace. I don't know. Milan would be the one I would plump for, I think, if I had to be pushed. And I'm the one doing the pushing, so I guess I do have to be pushed. And I would go for Milan. So, Paul, how about you?
Well, I'm not going to... it'd be a huge mistake for me to go against Adam here with a huge experience of Serie A football and watching week in, week out. I can't really disagree with that. I mean, if it's split into two camps here, logically, I think... internationally, with the experience they got of winning the league last year, they know how to get over the line. They've kind of come back from a long period not winning the title, so they know how to win it now. And they got, you know, as Adam has referred to, they've got a brilliant manager in Inzaghi. So logically, I think Inter, but my heart really wants Napoli to win it. I just think it'll be brilliant for Southern Italy to have Napoli win Serie A again. And I just dread to think what balance will be at the cemetery if they do win it this time.
How about you then, Stephen?
I'm going to be bold and say Napoli will do it. You know, I think the great thing about Napoli is that they the goals come from everywhere. I think they've already had like 10 different goal scorers. And you know, Luciano Spalletti, it's the holy grail for him, isn't it? You know, he's done so much in football, and but this Napoli team have everything within the armory to be able to do it. It is just the psychology of it. You know, it's taking those steps that they haven't done before. You know, the looming shadow, as much as Inter is, it's Juventus as well, that somehow they're going to get it right. I think, if I remember rightly, the next two fixtures are quite stern, though. So, you know, a dream would be that the 14, 13, maybe 16 points behind the leaders within, you know, before November's in. And that's a hell of a chase to face down. But, no, I'm going for Napoli here.
Good stuff. I'm glad there's a football romantic still left in you. The rest of us just obviously going for the more obvious bits. Good on you. Right. Well, that'll wrap us up there for this evening. So thanks everybody for your contributions. Thanks very much for coming on again, Adam. It's been a real pleasure and great to have you back on. Hopefully we'll do it again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed that. It's been a really good chat, and yeah, keep up the good work that you guys do as well. I always enjoy reading your stuff, so thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks, Adam.
Not at all. Yeah, thank you very much, and cheers, Stephen.
Oh, it's been
thanks for sorting this out as well as as well as all your contributions.
Oh no, it's been a joy as always. Yeah, you know, what a great topic, and you know, a brilliant way to spend an hour or so.
And in the blue corner, yes, thank you very much, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show again, Aidan. And yeah, it's been a brilliant show. I just love listening to Adam's insights into Italian football, all the references to style and glamour. And when we finish this podcast, I'm going back upstairs into the attic to take out my Benetton t-shirt, my dear daughter.
Well, I think we need photographic evidence of that.
I might use a stand-in for that one, Aidan.
I thought he was going to say he was going to open a bottle of Peroni.
Well, okay. We could all manage that. That would be
it's Moretti these days, Adam.
Well, I've been trying to string this out long enough for Italy to actually lose their unbeaten run, which they're moments away from doing. So there you go.
It's 2-1, isn't it? 2-1, isn't it?
Indeed. So they've been dethroned. At least they're seconds away from being dethroned. So that feels like a good point to end.
It's all over.
It's all over. There we go. Perfect timing. We've got the scoop that you might hear in a few weeks' time. Thanks very much, everyone, for listening. And we'll speak to you again in the future, no doubt, on another Lob podcast with East Football Times. But for now, thank you very much and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a Thees Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.